Thank you, Chair. House Bill 3067 would require the use of annual population data for allocations of certain funds to counties. It would apply only to monies distributed by the State Commission on Children and Families for Mental Health, Public Health, and Juvenile Justice Programs. I would like to bring to the attention of the committee chair that there is a -1 amendment which does not have the specific reference to the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. And also, rather than having the three, having public mental health, public health, and juvenile justice programs would only allocate programs of mental health and addiction services. That would be the -1 amendment.
Okay, thank you. And we have a couple of legislators. Well, they're already sitting here. Great. Gentlemen, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for hearing this bill, and for hopefully we can move this along with the -1 amendments, which we support. This is a bill. I'm currently serving on the State Commission for Children and Families. And this is an issue we get into, trying to take available funds to support where our needs are. And this bill moves us in that right direction, and a lot of times we've been using really outdated population data. So this bill will enable us to actually fund the need, where the need is. And I thank the chair for hearing it and help working with us to move this bill along. This is Representative Gene Wisnitz, State Representative District 53, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, State Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, and I believe, Madam Chair, you have the -1 amendment.
We have it.
And I just wanted to point out that I think that'd be a wonderful amendment if the committee so chose to agree to that. And move the bill forward.
And the -2.
The -2 also?
You have the -2, and you don't have that in front of you.
That one I don't have.
Okay. And in essence, what it says on the -1 amendments, line 6, delete the words amount of the allocation and replace with formula. And you're agreeable to that?
Yes, yes, Madam Chair.
Good, thank you. Any questions of this esteemed panel?
Madam Chair, I don't have the -2.
We don't have, nobody does. Oh, okay. We haven't gotten them back yet.
All right, we thought we were behind.
Oh, never. Representative Gelfand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question, and I don't know if it's for our colleagues or for people that are coming on future panels. I'm thinking back to my time working at DHS, where we had a formula by which we allocated funds to counties, and it was based on incidence of that particular type of issue among a population. And every time we went to try to adjust it, it was very difficult because for some counties that would lead to a pretty significant drop when there was an increase someplace else. What has the department and the counties, what have they said about how to even those shifts out so that there's not widely varying allocations from county to county, from biennium to biennium?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Gelser.
Rhymes with Alka-Seltzer.
I have a new tooth in the front. You're going to hear testimony from DHS and so also the counties, Crook and Washington and Deschutes County, their mental health directors, about how they adjust the formula and take in extra situations, not just the population, in distributing this money. So you'll hear from more experts than myself, probably not Representative Burley, but.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for being this bill to us.
You bet.
Okay, we have Bob Nickel, Scott Johnson, and Gina Nickel.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Nickel, Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services and responsible for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. I'm here to provide informational testimony on this bill. I think that I can support it, but I have just seen the -2 amendments this morning, and I think we can work toward agreement on those. But I wanted to provide first just a little context here. The money that we're talking about is for non-Medicaid eligible adults and children, and just certain categories of funding. Half of my budget is Oregon Health Plan. That's already, in my opinion, and I think most people would agree, if not everybody, that that money is already equitably distributed because it's based on the needs of people through a capitation rate that's set, and very technical process goes on. But I wanted to put that in context. Also, the what we call the back end or extended care services that allow people to move out of the state hospital have been allocated based on willing counties and providers coming forward over the last dozen years. And that money, I think that in the future, we need to get to a level playing field on that, and that's part of what the Community Services Work Group, the Central Oregon Community Services Work Group, and soon to be a Southern Oregon Work Group, we're going to be looking at those issues. So the funding that we're talking about are certain categories for non-Medicaid eligible adults, but they don't, so I just wanted to make sure that the committee understood that that's the universe that we're talking about here. Our approach has been to, as we've been able to find any funding that has been not specified to particular individuals or individual projects, we've been using that to level the playing field. And in response to the question that came up, I think, from Representative Gelser, we've been finding any opportunities over the last several years to what we call fill in the valleys and try to get everyone up to the per capita level in each of these several service elements. A good example of that is the acute care service element for indigent, non-Medicaid eligible adults. And I think we've gotten every county now, or every region, we're looking at on a regional basis, up to the per capita level, except for, I believe, Wayne County. So we've been working at this process. I should also say, in context, we've been working at this problem and this issue for at least 25 years. Ever since I've been in this state, the issue of equity has come up. Two sessions ago, we were able to make real headway on the mental health allocations, and we brought all of the counties up to the state per capita average at that point. The addictions issue has came up a little bit later. We're working on that. I've issued policy statements on each of these allocation issues so that we have, and we've gotten basic agreement from the counties on those allocation formulas. In mental health, we use something called the Kessler formula. It takes into account population is probably the main driver, but also things like poverty and a few other epidemiological factors. It's a federally derived formula out of the Center for Mental Health Services at the federal level. On the addiction side, we use a different formula that's based on a study that was done a number of years ago. It takes into account population, again, primarily. It's almost always the primary driver, but also the incidence of addiction problems, so that there is a factor built in for some communities do seem to have higher incidences of addiction issues. In terms of this bill, the one issue that I want to make sure that I put on the record is that the department and the governor's office are not in favor of putting allocation formulas themselves into statute. That's why I'm asking for the amendment that I believe is in the Dash 2 that allows for formulas to be updated annually. But when we get to allocating things, we need to have enough flexibility that we don't have to go to the statute every time we need to make a minor adjustment. So that's the reason why I've asked for the Dash 2 amendments to, instead of saying the amount of the allocation, to put formula in there. So I think that covers the context and the information that I wanted to provide. I've been working hard on this issue for the 4 years that I've been in the position. My intent is to get to a level playing field, and I really support the intent of the bill, and would be happy to work on this with people as we go along.
Thank you so much, Mr. Nickel. Any questions, Mr. Nickel? Oh,
thank you, Madam Chair. Not so much a question, good morning, but a comment. I think it's always excellent to rely on current population data, but something came to my attention that we are woefully underfunding the Population Research Center at Portland State University, of which we all rely on for their data. And I just thought I'd throw that out there for the committee, that we're going to continue to rely on data that we're not willing to fund in terms of providing it, then we're going to have some challenges here in the state. So
thank you. Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gina Nickel, Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. Just to get on record, I wanted you to know that our legislative committee, which is several counties, have discussed this bill, and we are in favor of the Dash 2 amendments. We also want to say that while this bill does not fix the equity problem because it doesn't put any more money into the system, it does help fix the equity issue by changing the population data. And I would agree wholeheartedly with what Representative Kotek just stated about funding the population.
Center. Thank you, Ms. Nichol. Any questions of Ms. Nichol?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Johnson. I'm the director of Deschutes County Mental Health Department. I'm here on behalf of the Deschutes County Board of Commissioners. And I'm also a member of the Oregon State Hospital Community Services Work Group and have worked with Mr. Nichol and others on a work group for Central and Eastern Oregon trying to ascertain what we need in terms of community services to support the work you are all trying to do, we are all trying to do in terms of the development of a new state hospital system. Again, we are very supportive of the now Dash 2s. I think I concur with what Mr. Nichol said. It seems very reasonable, the approach that we're taking here, and we're appreciative of our legislators in assisting us. The point that I wanted to make kind of fundamentally in terms of the value that we're trying to express through this bill is getting to a place where the most at-risk members of all communities in Oregon have equal access, if you will, to critically needed mental health and addiction services. And that's really the fundamental intent in terms of what we're trying to do. There certainly are plenty of stresses on the community mental health system in terms of our capabilities, but that's a value that's inherent in the statute in terms of what we're trying to accomplish. I won't reiterate what was said already on formulas, other than to say that the work that's been done by the Addictions Mental Health Division has been done in concert with community mental health programs. And as painful as these discussions are for everyone, it's been a very participatory process, if you will, in terms of trying to really get at what prevalence is all about and how do we come up with a sense of what a need is at a community level in a fair and balanced way, knowing that there's urban issues and rural issues and all of that. A little bit about Central Oregon, and you also will hear in a moment from the Crook County Mental Health Director. Just so you understand our enthusiasm, if you will, for this issue, we really do feel acutely the issue of population growth, and you have in your material that I'm providing a little bit on the population data, and Representative Kotek's correct. The source for that data is Portland State University. Since the census was done in 2000, our population has grown 32%. It's going up 27% in Crook County. And I often get in discussions with people, and people say, well, yeah, I understand it's growing a lot over there, but, you know, it's really growing all over the state. And really, the data doesn't entirely bear that out. There are, in fact, 5 counties that have gone down in population since 2000. There's another 11 over those 6 years that have gone up less than 3%. What I found interesting looking at the numbers yesterday, the 37,000 people we've added is more people than live in 18 of Oregon's counties, and about the number of people that live in Clatsop County. And that might be just kind of another way of thinking about, well, what are we really talking about? In a service economy, much as we have in Deschutes County, and certainly in terms of prevalence, any 37,000 people will bring with it some inherent need for services, and that's what we're trying to attend to and trying to advocate in support of this work. The other thing I would say, and I have really taken the challenge to heart, Bob has been out encouraging us to do our fair share of work in developing and expanding services to assist the new state hospital, and that's all about diverting people that really shouldn't be there or being able to transition people back to the community as soon as they're able to come back. It's about a 20% decrease in the length of stay in the new state hospital system, and we really support those intents, those goals, and believe in them wholeheartedly. That having been said, it is things like this legislation and the ongoing work that we're all trying to do to develop programs that are critical. We do not want to fail you, and we do not want to fail the community in not being able to deliver on what we all need when those new state hospitals open in 2011 or 2012. But I can tell you, without these kinds of matters being addressed, I do worry about exactly that, that what you will see, rather than an improvement and an enhancement of a community system, you're going to see a system in decline. And that's why we're here today, and that's what we're really trying to avoid. Again, we take very seriously what we understand to be the intent of the legislature and the governor's office. The last thing I'll close with, we have a number of support letters in our material, and one comes from NAMI of Central Oregon, and I pulled a sentence out of there, and I think it illustrates the pressure I feel, the responsibility I feel as a director and sort of living with this issue in the community. And Roger Olson, which is the NAMI president, wrote, "As a support organization, we hear from families who don't understand why their loved ones have received services in other Oregon communities but do not qualify in Deschutes County because the funding is considerably less." And, you know, that's the tension, the concern I have, and I kind of wanted to leave you with that. I thought that was a point well taken, because Roger, as the president of the local NAMI, will often field calls from family members that are trying to get help for a loved one. So with that, I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, for coming over today. Any questions? Representative Gelser?
Thank you, Representative Tomei. Is there a reason why the amounts will be calculated annually instead of biannually?
I can give you my perspective, and Bob may want to as well. Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, we thought long and hard about how even to approach this issue. The truth of the matter is there is no, to my knowledge, in Oregon, forecasting that is done in terms of population. So in other words, as you are trying to address the 2007-2009 biennium, there is not a reliable independent source of data on, for instance, how many people will be living in Deschutes County that might need mental health services that year. The only thing we have available to us is the certified data from Portland State University, which is historical. So if this were to move forward, and Bob was asked to use it in terms of determining the amounts for the counties, the only data he has to rely on is 2006 certified data, which places us at 152,000 people. The truth of the matter is we grow 6 to 7% a year. When we hit the midpoint in the next biennium, we will be at about 175,000 people. We felt we're already at a disadvantage given that. So our hope, I'll just speak for our county, was that there will be new certified data in December of 2007, which will cover July of 2007, and it seemed only reasonable to use the most accurate, the reliable data that was available. That was our thinking on the matter.
Can I follow up?
Follow up?
The reason I asked that question, in the legislative district that I represent, the county commissioners have now adopted a biennial budgeting formula, so they're budgeting on a biennium. If that district or another that was budgeting biennially ended up on the kind of short end of the adjustment stick, what would we be doing to the community mental health services in that community if in the middle of an adopted budget they needed to go back and reduce those services because typically counties receive their allocations biennially?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, we do exactly the same thing as a department. I actually do a three-year budget. That having been said, every month we receive on the Oregon Health Plan a capitation adjustment, and really what we need to be as good at as we can is some forecasting. I actually think the trending that's available here really will allow everybody to forecast for 2 years. So you just have to go through some analysis and some modeling of it. But the truth of the matter is our OHP funding is adjusted conceivably on a monthly basis. So an annual one, I frankly felt, was a very reasonable thing to do for all of us that have to forecast all the time what the needs are and what we're able to provide.
Okay, thank you.
That's it, Colin.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, if I could. Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I'm just trying to clarify in my mind what funds we're talking about. These are the non-Medicaid eligible adults and children. These are just funds distributed through the State Commission on Children and Families? Is that still? I'm looking at the explanation and then the amendments and trying to figure it out.
Madam Chair, Representative Callan, it's my understanding that the amendments, as I see them, have stricken the Commission on Children and Families from this, and it's now the Department of Human Services, and then the last, I think, section applies it only to those funds distributed through the two community mental health programs for mental health and addiction services. So I think the amendments narrowed, changed that, and then also further narrowed it.
Follow up.
So could you help us understand what funds those are?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Ramsey Callen, there are five what we call service elements, and it's a method for contracting out. So the five are non-Medicaid eligible children's services, non-Medicaid eligible adult services, crisis services to non-Medicaid eligible children and adults. That's a third category. Fourth category is acute psychiatric services for indigent non-Medicaid eligible folks, and the fifth one is service element 66 in addictions, which is called continuum of care, and it includes outpatient, intensive outpatient, and detoxification services. Counties have flexibility in that addictions category to fund anything in that range of services. So those are the five categories.
Now my second question.
Sure.
Here's the hard question. I understand the challenges that the high-growth counties are facing. I also understand the challenge of all counties for maintaining a base level of services. I mean, you need a certain amount of funding to keep a staff person or more, no matter what the population base is in terms of people requiring the services. So how does this impact the very small, especially some of the very small rural counties? I noticed the five that you mentioned that were losing population. I know that many times those very small counties have difficulty holding on to just a what I would call base framework of services, and I'm interested in how this would impact that kind of a situation.
Madam Chair, Representative Callen, actually that's an easy question to answer because in addition to the formula, we've created a base floor for all of the small counties, and I think it's $50,000 per small county in addictions, and I think it's that same number, maybe it's $100,000 in mental health, but we did take that into account so that we leave that floor there no matter what other adjustments we make.
Thank you.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to follow up on Representative Callen's question, which I think is an excellent one. Is that clarified in your rules of the base funding?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, it's actually not in our administrative rules, but it's in policy statements, and it's in our we publish our formulas and the allocations on a regular basis. So it's widely available.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure how other programs do it, but we have formulas for a variety of programs to have some statewide equity. One of the ways we make sure that things don't change is putting them into rule, because then there's a public process for changing them. Are you going to be putting any of the kind of the assumptions around the formula in rule?
I'm Chair Representative Kotek, I'm completely open and willing to do that. We did, as Mr. Johnson indicated, have a very open stakeholders process to get to the formula, but it probably makes some sense to move toward taking that policy and putting it into rule.
I would agree. Thank you.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What kind of flexibility do you have within the formula if you've allocated funds to a county and not due to lack of need that the people who are there, but a lack of capacity, be it providers or caseworkers to develop plans, the money is sitting unspent, while maybe in other counties there's the capacity to move forward and implement those services. Do you have the ability to shift those dollars around to places where they can be used?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, if we follow the formula, we would not do adjustments for those kinds of things. I do have to put on the record that I don't believe there's any county that's not using every cent that they get, because the whole system is underfunded, and that's another contextual piece that I want to put on the record, that there is no county in this state that doesn't have a waiting list or doesn't have to screen people, say, on crisis services to only take the people who are highest priority. I don't know if that answers your question.
And I guess one follow-up. Is there a reason why this is only the mental health and addiction services and not developmental disability and other community-based services as well?
I'm here, Representative Gelser. I hesitate to say that's not my department. It is my department, but it's another division within the department, and I simply don't know the answer to that. I think Mr. Taves, James Taves, could answer that question for you, though. I'd be happy to take it back to him or certainly make contact with him directly.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, developmental disabilities is on a formula due to a lawsuit, so it is funded just a little bit differently than mental health. Mental health and addictions was really the area that Crook County and Deschutes County and Washington County were having the most problems with, so this is what came forward. I would say when Rod Branyon gets up here from Washington County to testify, he is an expert in developmental disabilities, so he could probably answer your question better.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you all very much. And we will call up Rod Branyon and Nancy Tyler. Is there anyone here, anyone else who is here to testify? Okay.
So, Madam Chair and committee members, I'm Nancy Tyler. I'm the Community Mental Health Program Director in Crook County, operated by Lutheran Community Services, and I've actually been with the agency since 1993. Have worked there for 14 years, first 5 years as a therapist, and the next last 10 years as the director. So definitely come with some perspective on the changes that have occurred in the last 6 years. First, I wanted to just say I'm certainly very much in support of this amendment, House Bill 3067, the amended version, and definitely want to echo Mr. Johnson's comments about the value of this House bill in terms of really focusing on making sure that all the indigent individuals in the state of Oregon are receiving equal access to the services that are available. We know that it's all underfunded, but at least we're looking for equity as much as possible. And also, just to reiterate, there's been a lot of work done in Central Oregon on the state hospital plan, and I think Mr. Johnson already pretty well articulated our perspective on that, so I'll kind of skip over that and just kind of focus on some things more specific to Crook County. As the fastest growing county in the state for the last couple of years, and as Mr. Johnson also already said, 27% increase in population since the year 2000, so in the last 6 years, it's just been pretty amazing the changes that have been happening. One of the things I just wanted to really focus on is the impact for staff and for consumers of services because of the growth. Staff have consistently been indicating to me that in the last years that we've been seeing an increasingly severe, increasing number of individuals coming into the community with more severe issues. We're finding that individuals who are relocating to Crook County were previously receiving services typically in larger metropolitan areas, were usually more varied types of services were available. And while we have been working very hard to deliver services, increasing our evidence-based practice services, we're still very limited in what we can offer. And there's been a corresponding fallout where the staff themselves have been stretched and stressed as we try to really meet the needs of the consumers. So one of the things that's happened is really an increase in burnout of staff. And I'm going to give you just an example of kind of our adult services and the staff that we have. We have one supervisor program manager who oversees both the adult team and the children's team. We have 2.5 adult clinical staff. We have a community coordinator who oversees our clubhouse drop-in center, our supported housing project, and our supported employment program. Those 2.5 full-time clinic staff, well, the full-time, the full-time ones carry caseloads of over 80 clients. They respond to crises, which certainly has increased. They respond both during the day and after hours. They provide screenings, assessments, treatment in individual settings and group settings, case management, and the endless paperwork that goes with documenting all the services that are provided. And they might be scheduled to see clients, and then it's very frequent these days that a crisis will come up that will take them away from being able to provide the services for those who they're actually scheduled to see. As a result of the incredible demand on staff, turnover in the last 2 years has been unlike anything I've seen previously. We only have two staff that have been there longer than a year and a half, and most of our staff have only been there for 6 months. The number one reason for the turnover is the staff burnout. The demand is just incredible. And obviously the impact for the consumers having this kind of staff turnover is just really devastating. They just get connected with a person, getting going on track with services, and then the next thing we know, we're having a staff change. So I just wanted to really kind of give you the picture of what's happening kind of on the front line as we really struggle with keeping up with the demand and what the ramifications are locally. So thank you so much for your time and consideration of this bill. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rod Branion. I'm the mental health director for Washington County, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3067. I also wanted to give you a little different perspective on this in terms of what this may mean in terms of client services. Bob Nickel had mentioned before that there's been a great deal of effort on the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services in recent years to equalize funding across the state. That actually began in 2004. Prior to 2004, though, there were several counties in Oregon which were grossly underfunded by the state for the provision of mental health services. That's provision of mental health services to uninsured and underinsured persons. And Washington County was somewhat of a poster child for this problem in that we received about 25% of what we would have received had counties been funded equitably on a per capita basis. Now, there's a lot of reasons why we were underfunded to that degree, and it goes way back in history to the beginning of when community mental health programs were first formed and then changes that occurred over time. But the bottom line was there wasn't really a rational way to distribute state funds for mental health services. Like I said, in 2004, the state began to allocate mental health monies based on a formula that used population as a factor, and that was known as the CMHS Kessler model. Washington County received a 300% increase in funding that first year to bring us closer to equitable funding compared to other counties. And even though we received this much money, our population has changed since then, and we're starting to feel the effects of that population change and increasing demands on our services. Now, it's not that we're not appreciative, I want to make that clear, but I mentioned just to simply illustrate just how inequitable the distribution of funds can become over time without some form of a rational model for distribution of funding that's sensitive to the changes in the state's demographics. Now, for indigent persons prior to 2004, we only provide mental health services to persons that had severe and persistent mental illness and were also at risk of institutionalization. We didn't always have 24-hour crisis services available, and persons with milder forms of mental illness simply didn't receive treatment. Milder forms of mental illness, yet serious forms of mental illness. The increase in funding allowed us to begin to provide a base level of mental health services in our counties. And some of the changes that we've made since then is that now we have manageable case loads, and we're providing services with under acceptable practice standards to support people with severe and persistent mental illness. We've improved access for children, and adults to crisis services. We now have a mobile crisis team that serves approximately 1,000 people per year that are in crisis when they call. We've expanded eligibility so that people with serious mental illness who are uninsured or underinsured can now access needed outpatient treatment. We serve approximately 700 people per year through this program, and that's 700 people who would not have received services prior to 2004 if they presented with those issues. We've expanded our specialty and culturally appropriate mental health services to historically underserved populations, specifically culturally competent services to our Latino community, and specialized behavioral health services to older adults that we provide integrated in a primary care setting. Now, once we implemented these services, the other interesting thing about this is that the number of people that were receiving inpatient mental health care in hospitals and the number of people that were committed to the state hospital began to decline. And we believe that this is a direct result of improved community treatment in Washington County. Now, at the same time, our population is still increasing at a rate of about 1,000 people per month, and the demand for our services is increasing also. Some of this increase is due to pent-up demand and people slowly becoming aware of the services that are now available in the community, but some of it simply just due to plain population growth. And there is still unmet need for mental health services in our county, and it's a problem that needs to be addressed soon, or we'll be left with no choice but to begin rationing services like we have in the past. Another area for which the equity issue applies is addiction treatment services. Washington County is currently funded at approximately 57% of what we would receive if state funds were distributed on an equitable fashion. And like mental health, the lack of adequate funding for addiction treatment services has been a long-standing and growing problem in Washington County. Population growth in Washington County has greatly exacerbated this problem. And we all know what the impact of untreated substance abuse in our communities is. The last thing I'd like to say is that, as you're probably aware, the governor's recommended budget actually contained funding to address the problem of equitable funding for addiction treatment services. And it's our sincere hope that this issue will be addressed in the final legislatively approved budget and that funds be distributed in accordance with this Kessler model. Passage of House Bill 3067 is a step towards making this hope a reality. Thank you very much for your time. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them for you.
Yes, I have a question. You mentioned alcohol and addiction treatment. Do you also do treatment for gambling addiction?
Yes, we do. And that has a different funding formula that they use for that, that's based on historical utilization of that service that they adjust each biennium.
Have you seen the need for that increasing in the last couple of years?
Yes, absolutely.
Can you talk just a bit about that?
Well, we have been fortunate in that our funding has gradually increased with the need that has been presented in the previous year. I don't have the exact figures that are proposed in next year's budget, but I know that Washington County has shown substantial growth in the number of people that were being treated for addiction services, and that there is also a proposed increase for us in that.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Any further questions, Representative Kotek?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank both of you for what you do in your counties, and Scott as well. I just want to point out that the policy option package to expand to correct some of the inequity is not in the co-chair's budget at this point.
Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also wanted to thank both of you and all of you that do this work. I think the question that I'm struggling with, and maybe you can help me with, if I think about this from the perspective of the people in the district that I represent, the services that you describe that are available to the people in Washington County sound wonderful, and at the same time we know that we need more and that it's vastly underfunded. We would never be able to provide that level of service to people in Benton County just because our population isn't big enough. And so my question is equity really something that is determined based on population and how much we spend per person, or is equity the development of a common system of services so that people know that the level of services that they can achieve wherever they go in the state might be the same? I'm not convinced that this will help that. For a community like mine, I'm concerned that formulas based on population will actually exacerbate the issue of equity. Benton County, even though it's listed as one of the, it's towards the top here, one of those that's experiencing population growth, it's population growth within a smaller community as a whole. So that population is never going to be able to support those kinds of 24-hour supports, drop-in centers, and will consistently be stuck at the rationing of services. So that's where my concern is coming from. I don't know if you could help me with that on, I mean, what is equity? Is it the cost per person, or is it if I live in Benton County or Multnomah County or Crook County, I know that the same basic level of service is available to me, even though the total amount that's spent on me might be different from place to place.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, I believe that it's a combination of both of the things, of all the things that you're talking about. There is a base level of service that each county needs to be able to provide, or each region within the state needs to provide. In our case, we weren't able to provide that level of service because of there was no formula for distribution of funds. It was based on history that really didn't make any sense any longer. Like Bob Nickel had said earlier, there is a base level of funding that is embedded in the formula that they use for distribution of funding. I think that it's up to each county to prioritize the services that they believe that they need and to tailor those services to meet their own community. For the longest time, I didn't believe that Washington County would ever need mobile crisis services because we had so many other demands for mental health services. That just seemed like a pretty spendy option for us. Once we received more funding and we had other bases covered, that was something that we added. But you have to really build on the strengths and the services that you already have in each community to really make this work.
Can I follow up?
I appreciate the folks that are here today, but I'm just wondering how, and I know Crook is smaller, but is part of a regional growth. What are the smaller counties saying about this? Are there concerns from places like Benton County or Lincoln County that this could put into statute rather than into rule a formula or a process that might not be helpful to them?
Well, I can respond to that based on the discussions that we've had at the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. The smaller counties in the beginning stages of these discussions were concerned primarily about a base. And once they did have a base level of funding assured to them, there was more support for this formula. That's the best answer I can give you at this point in time. I think that under the proposed distribution, all counties receive some form of an increase, meaning small counties receive some form of an increase.
Mr. Nickel, would you come up and help us answer this?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, I'm Bob Nickel, Assistant Director of DHS. First of all, Madam Chair and Representative Gelser, I think you're asking a really good fundamental question, and that is equity really the best approach to this? And I would say that it's a pragmatic approach. It's not the best. If you look at the Community Services Work Group, which has been mentioned, and we prepared that based on what we heard, we chose not to take an equity approach there. We looked at what the prevalence of need and demand was, and then we took model budgets, in other words, budgets that we knew from good programs, these services would cost, and that's how we got to the numbers that showed up on page 34 of that document, which if you haven't seen, you might want to take a quick look at it. It's far in excess of what the governor's recommended budget is, so I have to be a little careful how I talk about this, but I just wanted to tell you that that was an example of a different approach to funding, which is not based, I mean, there may be an equitable, well, there would be an equitable aspect to it, but it was really based on what do services cost to meet the true demand. That's far in excess of what we have now, and obviously far in excess of what the governor's recommended budget has. In terms of how we would approach the addictions formula and whether some counties would lose and some would win, in the addictions formula and the policy that I put together, the discrepancies were so glaring and the pressure, frankly, was so great from counties like Washington and Clackamas and Central Oregon that we agreed, at least I reached a policy decision that we needed to start on this path whether we got additional funding or not. So there indeed are some counties that would lose. The biggest losers at this point would be Multnomah County, which over the next 4 or 5 years would lose $1.2 million if there's not additional funding in for A&D equity, and Klamath County. And I can tell you I've had very stern lectures from several of your colleagues about that issue. So in the addictions area, though, the demand is so great and the discrepancies are so glaring that I've decided that I have to start moving on this starting in the next year of the biennium and adjusting things until in 4 or 5 years we get to the point where all counties at least have the average per capita income. But in order to do that, some counties and some major losses would occur.
One last follow-up, please.
Okay, because we're running out of time.
Right. So, thank you, Madam Chair. So given that you're wanting to go in that direction and you're supportive of the general concept of the bill, why is it necessary to put this into statute rather than just having this worked through policy and rule through your department in the way that the formulas are put together?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, I think that it strengthens the position that I need to take on these kind of things to have it in statute. I know that the people who brought the bill forward feel that the airing of the issue is critical and the discussion of it is critical, and to have an additional piece in statute would help make sure that if I lose my job tomorrow or retire, since I am retirement age, my successor would follow in the same footsteps. I think that's the answer.
Thank you, Mr. Nickel.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, I mean, I seem to be at a disadvantage in this conversation. There seem to be a lot of budget talks, and I have yet to see a detailed programmatic listing of the budget. And Representative Kotek mentioned some programs, and I've seen a couple-page summary of comparing the co-chair's budget with the governor's budget. But I haven't seen any detail. Is that available?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I have a document that has the A&D equity formula and policy, and I can leave it here with staff so that you can have a copy of it. It has a county-by-county breakdown of where all of the counties are at and where we would be going.
Is this under the co-chair's budget?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, it could be talked about there. It did not come up in the ways and means discussion, and as was mentioned by Representative Kotek, the co-chair's budget eliminated the $4 million that would get us to equity in alcohol and drug services.
Thank you. If you could get that to Susan, and it seemed that, sir, that you had written testimony. If you could get that to Susan, that would be really helpful for us in our files. Before you go, Bob, some years ago we talked about combining mental health and services in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. That didn't go anywhere. Is there any interest in looking at that again?
Madam Chair, I had some requests for some discussion about this from the provider of detoxification services, Central City Concern, and since they provide services to, well, really citizens from virtually all the counties probably, but primarily Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington, we did have a meeting a couple of months ago, and I believe we have another meeting scheduled to talk further about how we might do that. The other issue that's come up is subacute psychiatric services, and so, yes, we are talking about that. The governor's mental health task force dealt with this regionalization issue and made what I think is a good recommendation, and that is that the state not try to impose this on counties, but that we should be open to the concept of regionalization where it makes sense. So what I'm doing is consistent with that recommendation.
Great.
That's correct. We've talked on an ongoing basis amongst the three counties about programs or projects that we could regionalize, and we haven't we're still in the talking phases on most of those.
I'm very interested in that, so if you have any further information, I'd appreciate getting it. Thank you all very much. Thank you for all the work you do. Colleagues, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3067. We're going to open up the hearings, public hearings on House Bills 2734 and House Bill 2914. Andy.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2734 would create the Oregon Bridge Program in the Department of Human Services to support individuals who are applying for and need assistance in qualifying for supplemental security income or Social Security disability benefits. The bill would also continuously appropriate money to DHS for carrying out the purposes of the program. It would direct that any federal payments received as reimbursements be paid back into the Oregon Bridge Program. And it would also require the Oregon Bridge Program assistance to include those presumed unable to pay child support. House Bill 2914 would create the General Assistance Program Fund as part of the Treasury, and that would be separate and distinct from the general fund. Any interest earned by the General Assistance Program would be credited to the fund, and all monies of the fund would be continuously appropriated to DHS and could only be used to provide grants of general assistance.
Thank you. And we have a list. Okay. Patty Whitney Wise, Nicole Palmateer, and John Mullen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I guess we've decided to have me go first. And for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. With me today, she will be testifying later, is my colleague Sarah Radcliffe from the Oregon Law Center to give the field perspective about general assistance. The Oregon Law Center has this as one of its main priorities this session. Obviously, this is a group of individuals that are very, very low income and in very great need. Just to give a brief bit of perspective, a number of states have general assistance types of programs that go by different names. The programs are rooted way back in history to work with people that have these kinds of difficulties. And in the more modern era, when SSI was passed by Congress, the federal government created an opportunity for states to have these kinds of programs where very low-income people that have disabilities were seeking to become eligible for federal benefits. And the federal government allowed states to have programs that where the federal government would reimburse for those people who did finally get federal disability benefits. By way of a little bit of further background, I just want to mention that in my previous role as director of Clackamas County Social Services, our agency was the first local agency to take over responsibility for the general assistance program. It was a very difficult decision because we knew how difficult the program was going to be to administer, but we had no doubt about the fact that there was a great community need and it was consistent with our mission. One of the things that I came to refer to the general assistance population was really as the poorest of the poor. When you think about having a disabling condition that would last a year or more, no more than $1,500 in assets and no more than $50 in cash, these are folks that were really, really in desperate circumstances. In many instances, the people that we saw had no income at all. A little bit of further background, the General Assistance Program was really a general assistance program in the real sense of the word when it was first established here in Oregon. In fact, we used to be able to have a temporary assistance program for people who were in a difficult circumstance. So an example I give in my testimony is about a day laborer that had a broken leg, had no unemployment compensation, no workers' compensation in some instances, would be able to qualify, and then when they literally got back on their feet, could go back to work. And so that was a really good program. In addition, there were a few people that wound up staying on general assistance for a period of longer periods of time. They didn't qualify for federal benefits, and some of them wound up in long-term care facilities. But then with budget cuts in 1995, the program was really changed to a pre-federal disability program. So in other words, basically what had to happen at that point is that you had to demonstrate that you were unable to work for a year or better. And, of course, the local agencies helped the people to gather that information and make the medical or psychological determination that, that these folks, in fact, were good candidates for being found eligible for the federal benefits. The general assistance program was always on a roller coaster because there's general fund dollars. It's purely general fund funded, even though the federal government does reimburse for those people who successfully get the federal benefits. And so it was that in January of 2003, the program was actually eliminated, and then it was restored later in that year. When the restoration happened, though, it was really merely a shadow of what the program used to be, because in that instance, then, you had to not only have the disabling condition where you couldn't work for a year or better, meet all of the eligibility criteria, but you really couldn't be eligible for Social Security disability insurance. And that meant that, in essence, that anybody that had any kind of work history was not going to be eligible for the program. So in Clackamas County, my recollection is the highest the caseload ever reached was 195 clients. But then with the last portion of the program, when it was opened up just for those people who would qualify for SSI, we had about 20 clients. So the program, in some ways, I used to refer to it as specific assistance because it was no longer a general assistance program in any way, shape, or form. So one of the things that I would like to also draw your attention to, but I'm not going to go over this, is that in Clackamas County, we were fortunate to be able to secure a federal grant to help work with people. It was a demonstration grant by the Social Security Administration to help people who were homeless be able to get the federal benefits. And we also were able to get another grant, for a HUD grant, to help provide for some housing services. And the program has been very successful, and you'll also hear a little bit later about the program in Lane County. There are only two in the state of Oregon. But the problem with a federal discretionary grant is that they run out of time. And so eventually this program will no longer be funded. And then what we are left with is the need that continues to persist in Oregon. And speaking from a local community perspective, what often happens with people who have no assistance these days is they, of course, wind up being homeless, but they also wind up inappropriately in law enforcement situations. And we do know that a number of the former general assistance clients in Clackamas County died. There were a couple of suicides. There were a couple in the paper, in fact. And then we also lost track of people because they had no place to be, no address, and so forth. And so our request is that the committee seriously consider the restoration of the general assistance program, at least at the level where both SSI and SSDI eligible feasibility would be considered so that we could have a program that would meet the needs of some of the most difficult situations in the local community. So whatever we wind up calling it, I hope we do reinstate the program. And I just also mention very quickly that there are amendments to 2914, and the consensus of the group of us that are working on this is that we would like to see that be the vehicle and to have that particular bill amended. And the final thing that I will mention is that Ellen Lowe, who's known to many of you, could not be here today. She apologizes for that and wanted to let you know how supportive she is of restoring the program on her behalf as an individual who's worked tirelessly for general assistance over the years and also on behalf of the Oregon Food Bank. Thank you.
John, will somebody be talking about the amendments, and if they're are they substantially different from the original bill?
Madam Chair, I believe Nicole Palmatier, who's down right next to me, will talk about the amendments. And basically what we decided, principally the three of us in working together on this, is that we would use the amendments to amend 2914, which in essence takes most of the Oregon Bridge Program bill and puts it into the other bill, with the exception of the name. So we may wind up deciding to name the program something different if you were in agreement. But in any event, we're in consensus about the Dash 1
Great.
Amendments.
And we're going to hear from all three of these before we ask questions, colleagues. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Palmatier, here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And we would like to thank you for hearing this bill regarding the General Assistance Program. Just to answer your question right up front, that is exactly correct. O4AD did put a bill down this session to look at the restoration of general assistance, and what the Dash 1 amendments do is simply take the language from 2734, which we agree are very good changes to the general assistance program, and just put that into 2914 in order that we're all moving on the same page and hopefully offering efficiency in the political process, because we're all fans of that. So on behalf of O4AD, the general assistance program was a very tremendously important life preserver, as John said, to the most desperate and the most needy. When you're at that point in life where you have no other options, you have to be ineligible for veterans benefits, unemployment. There can be no other options in order to apply for the general assistance program. You've really reached an option where you're looking for anything that can help you sustain life, really, at that point in the game. And I can say that this summer, when I had the opportunity to visit our area agency in Rogue Valley, I actually had one of the case managers who had received a phone call that day, somebody who is about approximately my age, in their 30s, who had been employed but had lost their job, had been in a horrible accident, was looking to apply for SSDI, but what do I do in between? And that's exactly what general assistance does. It's the what do I do in between, and then allows that to be repaid back from the federal government. In talking to DHS, the repayment level was approximately 60-70% at the time the general assistance was in its best form. And what made that possible, I think, was the general assistance liaisons, which to us is an incredibly important part of the process. The liaisons work with the individual applying for general assistance to help them through the application for their benefits, to ensure that this person can be eligible, has the best case possible, as well as then helping them feed into the other programs that might be available for them, but to make sure that we're also being able to realize the highest return that we can possibly get for this kind of program, because we understand how limited general fund is and we want to be able to use that efficiently, but also understanding that this population of people without some sort of short-term limited benefits are going to be the ones that we see in emergency rooms. They're going to be the ones that are going to be costing us a lot more in services, because it's going to be very acute, very much at that high level that they cannot be turned away. But this is the kind of thing that allows you to stay in a shelter or stay in some sort of a residence area, to have groceries, to be able to just sustain life until you're able to receive those kinds of benefits. And I know that there is a lot of question about funding and where will that come from, but in a program of this nature, we've seen what the return can be without it. We've seen that now in the interim with the two to 3 years where we've not had the general assistance program, and in our agency offices, we have a number of those kinds of requests, and we have a very limited number of places that we can turn to right now without this program while they wait for those benefits. And the benefits process is very long. It's not an efficient process necessarily and can range from a few months to a few years, and that's a pretty long period of time for somebody who has no other alternative to do to be able to try to make it out there on their own. So we are, of course, supportive of House Bill 2914. We would hope they would move on to Ways and Means to at least be able to have that conversation about how to restore assistance to this very particular, very unique population who are indeed in the most desperate situation. So I thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and we introduced a proposal on general assistance before we knew that O4AD was moving in the same direction. We're delighted to find that to be the case. This is a population that has been neglected over the years, and the difficulty in getting through the process, I think, is one of the main reasons we're here today. We know that these people need to stabilize their living situations in order to look at other opportunities, and I know Representative Gelzer has many times raised the issue of let's not just get them on SSI or SSDI, let's look at job opportunities too. And I would say this ties very well into the prior discussion on the bill this morning about mental health issues. For many people, if they're not in a stable living situation, their mental health issues escalate. And so the first thing you want to do is get them into a stable situation so that some of those mental health issues calm down on their own, and others can be addressed, to the point where they very well might be able to work part-time or full-time. But right now, these folks, many of them trying to get through the process, are not in stable situations, so it makes it more difficult for them even to apply for SSI, SSDI. I'm wondering, since the end of the program, how many folks have literally disappeared into the woods and are not able to apply for those benefits. So there's the additional issue of federal dollars for these folks that would help them stabilize that are not coming into the state of Oregon because there's no one there to help them move through the process, and there's no way to stabilize them other than some shelter programs while they're awaiting that return. So we're also losing out on federal dollars that could help these individuals stabilize their situations, help local communities, help local businesses by having folks in housing rather than having to live on the streets. So for all of those reasons, and obviously as a hunger relief task force, the need for people to have a place to live so they can provide meals for themselves is also a significant concern. So we are very supportive of the amendments to House Bill 2914 and would put our support behind that vehicle, and we ask you to seriously consider this. There isn't a cost issue. When the program was up and running in its latest version, I believe it was costing about $2 million a biennium, but because we have not had those retroactive dollars coming in from the federal government to help pay for what general assistance program was provided by the state, it would probably cost about $11 million to get it back up and running again. However, those costs would drop in future biennium because of the revolving fund where the money would come back in. I think that's probably one of the most important points, is that most of the money Oregon would put out would get reimbursed and then be in a fund to help the next set of people who need that assistance while they're trying to move through the process. And I'd like to just end with a letter to the editor that was submitted recently. And it says, I quote, as the nation focuses its attention on the condition of substandard military health care, and our president is deeply troubled by reports of the same, our family is focused on the pain and suffering of a broken Social Security Disability Administration and the resulting suffering of thousands who have been denied Social Security disability benefits or are stuck in the lengthy appeal process. Our 34-year-old daughter was stricken 2 years ago with severe rheumatoid arthritis and connective tissue disease. She has been denied Social Security disability twice. Reason, she is not sick enough. And it is in the appeal process, which is backlogged 2 years. Her savings are gone, and her credit card bills mount. Oregon Health Plan recently accepted her, but she avoids homelessness only because we, her parents, cover rent and utility expenses. She would otherwise be among the ranks of thousands who are homeless, who have either been denied Social Security disability benefits or are waiting through the lengthy appeal process. Attention must be brought to this broken system. And I would say, while that is, we do need to address the federal issue too, we need to help these families in this process now. There are many individuals who don't have families that can support them through rent and utilities, and we need to be that place of last resort to help stabilize them. So we ask your passage of this measure onto Ways and Means. Thank you.
And thank you to the three of you who are such tireless advocates for this poorest of the poor and the most needy. Thank you so much, and I'm open now to questions. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that it's the most important thing, but I'm particularly directing this to Mr. Mullen. Tell me a little bit more about why it went away. Is it a sunset issue or...
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, actually the General Assistance Program has been around for a long, long time, and basically what it ran into was it stands out in the budget as a general assistance, a general fund expenditure, and during the times that we went through in the early part of 2003-2005, it was really very vulnerable because the legislature was looking for places where it needed to trim general fund. So it was a victim of that, I believe. And I don't recall anybody ever making the case that it was a program that was not necessary. It was one of the awful things that had to be done to get the budget in balance.
A follow-up? It's actually just a comment, follow-up comment, but all of our budget wrangling aside and the credibility of these witnesses, I just want to go on record that I think we ought to go to work session and get this done.
Thank you, Representative. I think it's $11 million is going to be hard to find in Ways and Means, but I don't disagree at all. Any other questions? Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is more of a comment than anything. Sitting on the subcommittee for Ways and Means, I want to see this bill. I think our role is a good policy. And I don't think anyone would disagree that this is good policy. And if there are, I'd like to hear them. I mean, we cut this program. It was probably one of the most immoral things we did when we made cuts in the special sessions. I want to discuss this in Ways and Means, and I hope we can move it on regardless of the potential fiscal. Thank you.
Any other? Chair,
yes.
Patty, I guess more is for you, since you mentioned it. So you're thinking the jump start is about $11 million, and then once it gets all squared away and stabilized, and they're thinking about $2 million?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, that is the historic cost, around $2 million or so. I believe that's the number they settled on last session when we were trying to reinstate the program at that point or get it funded. Once looking at the money coming back in from the federal government, it could be slightly higher in future years, mm-hmm. but that's around the amount.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome. Anything further? Thank you again very, very much. We will hear Vic Todd, Bob Lawrence, and Deanne Hartwig. Please.
Good morning. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Vic Todd, Administrator for the Self-Sufficiency Programs within Children's, Adults, and Families of the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to testify on House Bill 2734. I'm not going to go through my written testimony since
you've
heard so much. For the Children's, Adults, and Families Self-Sufficiency Programs, as you well know, there are two bills, House Bill 2180 and Representative Kotek's bill, House Bill 2469, which would establish a family state SSI program, which is designed to deal with the families that are also in pursuit of SSI eligibility. This House Bill 2734 appears to be directed at adults, and what we're recommending is an amendment to the two bills now that would clarify that House Bill 2180 and 2469 are addressing the family scenarios, and this bill being discussed today would address those for adults to provide some clarity around ensuring that families would be served through that are eligible for TANF would be served through this state family SSI program. And so I've included a proposed amendment for that purpose.
And your written testimony.
And the written testimony includes that.
Great.
So with that, I'll end because I know you're short of time.
Thank you, Mr. Todd.
If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Any quick questions for Mr. Todd? Thank you so much.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Deanna Hartwig. I'm the administrator of the Office of Federal Resource and Financial Eligibility, Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. I, too, will just go right to the impact of this particular legislation. You have a very good understanding of what it is proposing to do. The Oregon Bridge Program would bring new clients to the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division. It's estimated that at full capacity, we would serve an additional 3,000 clients with disabilities each month. We believe that the caseload would reach about 1,400 by the end of the 2007-2009 biennium, and the remaining number of clients would come in by the end of July 2011. The expected general fund need would be $26 million for the 2007-2009 biennium and $52 million for the 2009-2011 biennium. We do receive about a 70% recovery on the cash benefit that we give to clients. The SSA recovery is just on the cash grant. To ensure that we can recover the cash assistance funds, we do have some recommendations for changes in the bill language. We would require that everyone make application for supplemental security income as well as supplemental security disability income, that the disability determination criteria be aligned fully with Social Security's disability criteria, and as Mr. Todd suggested, that it clarify that the eligible clients for this particular bill would be between the ages of 18 and 65 without dependent children. We believe that the offset of the recovery of the supplemental security income funds and the positive outcomes for clients who were ultimately awarded an ongoing cash benefit and medical assistance is really important to acknowledge. And we believe that this bill, with some amendments, would be good public policy. However, as you well know, the program costs are not included in the governor's recommended budget.
Thank you very much. It puts you in a tough position, doesn't it? Any questions? Yes, Representative Kopek.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here. Could you discuss how you came up with the 3,000 needy clients? And the reason, I'm not questioning, I'm just curious because it's 3,000 folks we have out every month who need, right, that are in that limbo, and I'm just wondering how you came up with that.
We worked with Judy Moore Peterson, who is the manager of the department's forecasting unit. She is very familiar with the original general assistance program that John Mullins referenced, the scaled-down version that the department initiated in 2003. So we have a sense of the numbers of people who presented when it was the limited supplemental security income-only program or when it included people who could apply for supplemental security disability income. So we have a sense of what those caseloads have been throughout, oh gosh, probably 10 or 15 years. So we've just done some extrapolations on what we think that new group out there could potentially be, and it's pretty much based on our historical experience.
Thank you. Follow up? Thank you, Madam Chair. Did we do any tracking of the people who were on the program after it was eliminated?
Representative Kotek, Madam Chair, unfortunately, if they're not receiving some kind of service from Seniors and People with Disabilities or someone, other division in the department, we have no way of knowing where they are. I think John Mullen and some of the other directors of our community partners try to keep in contact with individuals after the programs were reduced to understand what the impact was, what stresses and conditions and problems they experienced, but we have nothing but anecdotal information, unfortunately, about what happened to those individuals.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, too, in your testimony, you mentioned that you expect 70% recovery of the cash assistance. Are you using the numbers back in 95, or how are you coming to that?
Representative Olson, Chair Tomei, actually, we have information on the recovery since the inception of the original GA program, the General Assistance Program. And throughout the years, we are running consistently at a 70% recovery from the ultimate Social Security Administration award. One of the reasons we don't have 100% recovery, some individuals may have applied in another state and they would have first claim on the recovery amount. Some individuals, even though we try to make sure that we're applying the impairment criteria correctly, are ultimately denied by Social Security Administration. Some individuals have an initial denial. They don't do a timely application for hearing with Social Security Administration. We continue to do the general assistance cash payment. So there are a variety of reasons why we don't reach a higher than 70% recovery.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Identify yourself, please.
Madam Chair, thank you for this chance to testify on behalf of House Bill 2734. My name is Bob Lawrence, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I'm also the chair of the Clackamas County Area Agency Advisory Council, and I've been intimately involved with this issue for some years now, for 4 years. When the Governor's Commission did our community forums in conjunction with the Area Agencies on Aging and Senior and People with Disabilities, we visited 20 cities, and the issue of the application for SSI came up over and over again. So we were made acutely aware of the need for a program. We feel like the Oregon Bridge Program is essentially the restoration of the General Assistance Program. At whatever cost, we need to seriously consider this. At this point, I am reminded of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and our fellow citizens are dealing with a basic thing of food and security and housing, and quite frankly, as a trained social worker, I was trained to not sympathize but to empathize. And if I were in this situation, I really don't know how I could cope. So we're urging that House Bill 2734 be referred to Ways and Means so that we can have an honest and open discussion about this program. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thanks for all the work that you do. Any questions of anybody on the panel? Thank you again. We have Sarah Radcliffe and Melanie Calvin and Laura Wetzel. Sure.
Take it all.
No, it's not. Okay. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Radcliffe. I'm a lawyer with the Oregon Law Center, and I focus on assisting low-income Oregonians with legal issues related to state and federal public benefits. I'd just like to make a couple points about the SSI-SSDI application process and then share a couple of client stories and talk a little bit about how people would use their general assistance benefits if this bill were to be passed. On average, in Oregon, it takes 2.5 years to complete the SSI-SSDI application process, and most claims are denied at the initial application level. So most applicants, even if they're successful, end up going through this very long process. And even though a lot of applicants are eventually found eligible based on severe disabilities, the initial SSI-SSDI denial, which, as I mentioned, is pretty routine, can preclude Medicaid eligibility until they're ultimately found eligible for SSI or SSDI. So during that period of 2.5 years on average, these people who generally have severe disabilities don't have any benefits whatsoever, not even medical coverage. And another point that I wanted to make is that applications with assistance are much, much more successful than applications without any assistance. And if that assistance is provided up front, people tend to be approved at the initial application level rather than having to go through these multiple stages of appeals. This is something that Melanie Calvin can talk about a little bit more, but the SOAR program, which trains advocates to help people go through this process, reports that for homeless applicants, the application at the initial, or approval at the initial application is around 10 to 15% nationwide, and in Oregon, with assistance through the SOAR program, 67% of homeless applicants are approved at that initial level, so it just saves a lot of hardship and a lot of time for everybody to get that assistance up front. In addition to representing clients, I answer a statewide public benefits hotline, and I'm in touch with a lot of community organizations and with our client community. And I just want to mention that people who are in this predicament of waiting for their SSI or SSDI to come through are generally living on zero income. A lot of people are living in tents in the woods. They're living on the streets, living out of a car, or moving from friend to relative to friend. Some examples include a man who was a logger for 20 years who ruined both of his knees and now can hardly walk, who's living through the charity of a former boss on a trailer on the boss's former boss's property, or an elderly man who was diagnosed with cancer and told that he had less than a year to live, who is living in a homeless shelter right now and may not even survive to see the benefits of his SSI benefits and the health care coverage that would come with those. Melissa Mona is the coordinator of the HOPE program in Lane County, which John Mullen talked about the similar program in Clackamas County. She couldn't be here to testify today, but she submitted written testimony, which I handed out with my testimony. And I just wanted to read a story that she shared about one of her clients that I thought was very compelling. This is Bruce. Bruce is a 54-year-old man who has lived outdoor for over 15 years. He cannot read or write. He was in special education classes growing up and dependent on his parents until they passed away 4 and 6 years ago. He was diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder as a child and continuously as an adult. When he could not afford to see a doctor for his medication or pay for prescriptions, he began self-medicating with methamphetamine. Bruce sleeps outside behind a senior center near the river. This is in Eugene. During the day, he collects cans and bottles to earn money for the things that food stamps don't cover, batteries for his flashlight and radio, clothing, toilet paper, soap, etc. Bruce applied for and was awarded general assistance. I should mention, this is a story about someone who was granted general assistance and lost it when the program was terminated. He was able to obtain housing through the LIFT program, a joint initiative of HUD and the VA administered locally by St. Vincent de Paul. The LIFT program provided Bruce with an apartment for the first time in his life. He was required to spend most of his GA cash assistance each month for his portion of the rent. He scheduled appointments to get dentures, as he had lost all of his teeth over the years. Bruce was hopeful for the first time in many years that his life was turning around. He had filed a claim for SSI, was housed, and had medical insurance. He completed an outpatient drug treatment program and was free of all drugs and alcohol for the first time in years. When GA ended, the LIFT program staff explained to him that he would still be expected to pay his share of his monthly rent or he would have to leave. A trained vocational rehabilitation case manager worked with Bruce, helping him apply for jobs and complete resumes, to no avail. With no teeth, no work experience, and obvious cognitive and mental health disabilities, Bruce was never called in for an interview to the 30 or so places he applied to. He had to leave the apartment and go back to the woods. Bruce told me that he thought it was some kind of joke to the people in charge. They gave him hope for a brief period, let him remember what it was like to lock a door behind him at night and sleep undisturbed. They let him feel like a real person again, and then they took it away. Bruce relapsed into methamphetamine abuse and severe depression. To make it worse, his OHP benefits were downgraded from OHP Plus to OHP Standard, and he lost his dental benefits. He had been waiting for months to get an appointment to get dentures, and his benefits were downgraded the day before he was finally scheduled to be seen for dentures. I think that story just kind of illustrates the, you know, real impact that this program has on people who are in this situation. Medical care, obviously, is critical. For people, I also want to point out that it's critical for developing a record of a disability, which can make the SSI application much more successful. It's very hard to prove a disability if there's no record of treatment, no statements from doctors or evaluations from doctors. And also, you know, people who have severe disabilities often have chronic health care needs and are forced to rely on the emergency room rather than getting good preventative care because they don't have health insurance. In terms of housing, there are very few housing resources for people with zero income, but if people had just a little bit of income, more opportunities open up. They might be eligible for subsidized housing programs or could leverage rent assistance, or they might be able to rent a room in a shared housing situation. Also, if someone's approved for Section 8, you still have to pay a security deposit, so they could use their GA to pay a security deposit. So a little bit of money might be able to help some people transcend homelessness. The stipend could also cover basic needs that aren't covered by food stamps, things like laundry, clothing, shoes, toiletries, toothpaste, feminine hygiene products. All of these things are obviously really essential and not covered by food stamps. It could also pay for bus tickets to get to doctor's appointments, appointments with a lawyer if the person is at that stage in the appeals process. Melissa Mona, in her written testimony, pointed out that you'd have to collect 50 cans or bottles in Eugene in order to redeem them and get bus fare for a round-trip ticket to an important appointment. In Portland, you'd have to collect 64 cans or bottles. So a little bit of money could go a long way in terms of allowing people to do these really necessary things. It could also pay for a storage facility for a few months so someone could hold on to their belongings during a period of homelessness or a few nights of respite in a hotel or shelter. So, you know, I think these people with disabilities who are surviving on zero income are really the most vulnerable people in Oregon, and they're entitled to federal benefits. They're just stuck in this limbo where there's a lag time before they can access these benefits, and a little state assistance could really, really help. And I hope that you'll consider this bill, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ms. Bradley. Any quick questions from Ms. Bradley? Thank you so much. And I know we have three other people who are wanting to testify. If there's anybody else, you'll have to let us know because these will be the last three. Go ahead.
I brought another fellow, too.
Maybe, Sarah, maybe you could move off and let him move over here.
Thank you.
Great. Please go ahead and identify yourself.
I'm Melanie Calvin, and I'm an employee of Central City Concern. I'm a frontline worker for SSI. I'm just going to go ahead and read my statement, and I'm definitely open to questions. Sarah mentioned the SOAR program, which is a training program for case managers to expedite the SSI process. And I've had the honor and pleasure of helping train over 200 case managers this last year on how to do that. So there's some systemic pieces that we're working on, too. So anyway, I'm joining you today to introduce you to two of the strongest people I know. Excuse me. Darn it, Laura.
Not my fault.
When I was asked if I'd like to add my perspective to this conversation, these two wonderful people immediately came to my mind. I will start out, though, by telling you briefly about my job. I have the honor of being a Social Security disability advocate. I've been doing this for 6 years. My first 3.5 years were working as a paralegal for an attorney that specialized in SSI. My last 2.5 years have been with Central City Concern as a benefits specialist, initiating applications as well as following them through the entire appeal process. I've recently had the additional honor of becoming a trainer for the state of Oregon for advocates and non-attorneys who work with these applicants. As a paralegal, I assisted over 600 appeals at varying levels of administrative and federal court review.
I screened over 400 claimants for potential eligibility. An SSI attorney is paid on a contingent fee basis. In other words, they only take cases they believe they can win, and I determined which cases we took. At Central City Concern, I've represented or consulted on 195 claims to date, so in 2.5 years. The claimants that I work with are considered the most difficult in this line of work, as most of them have been homeless, have mental illness, and many have a co-occurring disorder of addiction. Part of my job is to do street outreach to improve the success of the success rates of these claims. That means in some instances I actually go under the bridges or beat the bushes for my clients. There's only one demographic that's actually harder to deal with than my folks. and that would be the street youth, who have no medical history or treatment history whatsoever, as well as the same transient problems of homelessness and mental illness. I'm the only benefits specialist at Central City Concern. It's a large nonprofit. Central City employs about 500 people. I get referrals from about 10 different sister agencies under this umbrella. So out of my 195 people that I've worked with, 61 of these claimants have been granted benefits. 96 are still pending, and I stopped working with 38 of them for one reason or another. Some of these reasons are the claimants have withdrawn their claims from sheer disappointment and discouragement from their first denial. Cases have been closed out of our programs. We lose touch with them. We provide housing, and they go out of housing. Many of them are too mentally ill or paranoid of the government to persist in this process. And I've actually had two clients die waiting for their benefits. And those two that died had recently gotten a denial that said they weren't sick enough, and they died in their apartments. For the claims that have been approved on my watch, an average of 16 months now was taken in doing so. That figure used to be 24 months. I'm starting to have some impact on this early intervention to the process. Needless to say, that this is a very large number of people for one person to have encountered in 6 years. That's upwards of 800 people. This is just a lot of people that are the most destitute out there. But enough about me. getting back to why I'm here. This is Laura. Laura is a lady that should write a book. She struggled with addiction much of her life. She was busted and spent time in prison. When she got out, boy, was she loaded for bear. She achieved incredible success considering what she had lived through in the first half of her life. I will let her tell you, as Paul Harvey says, the rest of the story. I helped her start her SSI claim in February 06. She's still waiting for approval on her benefits all these months later. Her endurance and her patience far exceeds mine. She calls me about once a month to tell me how much she appreciates me.
More than that.
All the while, I'm desperate to get her small amount of SSI. She's lived with next to nothing for a long time, longer than before I met you. And this is James. When I met James, he told me how long he'd struggled with mental health issues. I gotta make a comment here. It's hard to be here and talk about these things. Jim asked, when I asked him, he says, "Oh, you want me to be your poster boy?" And I said, "No, I want you to show your strength and tell your story." Jim's wrestled with mental health issues most of his life, namely depression and suicidal thoughts. He's got an organic chemical imbalance. I was able to get substantive records documenting his psychiatric hospitalizations from 10 and 15 years ago. All these years, he's tried to keep working. He's not been able to work a steady job since September 04. Now he has additional physical conditions on top of his mental health issues of sleep apnea. He suffers from narcolepsy and diabetes. He struggled with sleep studies, CPAP breathing machines, and all kinds of medicines over the years. He's a wonderfully spiritual and intelligent guy. He's one tough hombre, and I'm really proud to be helping him. And somehow he's found a way to keep on keeping on. So thanks very much for letting us share today. It was a very, very black day when GA went away. I was working for the attorney at the time, and when we got the bad news, I sat there and cried. And for the next month, many, many of our clients came in and asked, what do I do now? And your question about was there any follow-up done? We got some of that follow-up. Many of them went into the woods. No one asks to become disabled. No one really wants to live on $623 a month. And it's very, very hard to watch these people try and survive through this broken system that we call our social safety net. So I sincerely hope that we can bring back this desperately needed resource. I wake up every morning very determined to make things different where and when I can. There are very few SSI specialists like me in Oregon whose sole job it is to navigate the Medicaid and disability systems. It's extremely difficult for a physically and mentally ill patient to see this lengthy process all the way through without an advocate, without any income, and some form of medical coverage. Please help us keep fighting this good fight. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Calvin.
This is Laura. I'd like Laura to introduce herself.
Hi, my name's Laura Wetzel. Madam Chair and all the representatives, I learned that today. I'm in agreement with the gentleman that spoke earlier about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I'm not cognitively dysfunctional. I have 1 year in on my master's in social work at Portland State University. I suffered 28 years of addiction, heroin addiction. I spent 4.5 years in the penitentiary for my drug crimes, nonviolent. I got out. I had the parole officer from heaven, and he helped me, held my hand all the way until I got a GED, and I got such good grades on my GED that I got a free term of college from the Launder Learning Center. And I chased my education as hard as I chased my addiction, or harder. And I was nominated for commencement speaker at Portland State for my bachelor's in criminal justice. And then I got accepted in. I didn't make it because I had purple hair, but that's another story. I made the top three anyway. But and then I got accepted into the social work program there, and that's such a huge honor because it's 1 in 8 people get accepted. And so I was really proud. And then I got student of the year, and that was just like, my head just went, whoa. And when I got my award, this is such a cute little story. I'm nervous, so I'm trying to make it. It had a great big picture on an easel, and it was just my face. And I go running into the room, ah, that's me! and one of the representatives says, you need to calm down. I said, don't tell me. This is called flooding. I get extra excited because I haven't felt my whole life. So anyway, when I was getting counseling for my, I was a prostitute in my addiction. And I ended up in Skid Row in Los Angeles and got ran over by a large diesel truck. And I was in the hospital for 4 months. I was in a coma for a month. Broke every bone in my face. He ran over me and tried to kill me. So I've had 7 reconstructive surgeries on my face. And I'm getting ready to get new dentures myself. They're pulling them right now. I sure hope I don't get cut off with no teeth. That would be horrible. But anyway,
Tell them about your business.
I will. So anyway, what business?
your social work business.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I even that's why I got Student of the Year and Seroptimist Woman of the Year, was because I opened two houses in Portland, one in Portland and one in Vancouver, and they were called Women Embracing Freedom Together, and I wore nine hats. I was a case manager, I did the one-on-ones, I did the UAs, I did the rental, I did the raising of all the furniture. I mean, I had a two-day garage sale and raised $8,000. That's how much energy I had into this. And I got accused of embezzling $8,000 or $4,000. The rent monies for both houses came up missing in the bank. And of course, because I was an ex-felon, I was automatically guilty. I stole it. And they found it. But not until they came to my home and fired me and closed down my houses and dropped all those women and nine children with no help. And one of them ended up ODing and dying, and the eight other all relapsed. Because they weren't strong enough yet to make it on their own. But anyway, so I went into a severe, severe, severe depression. After they found the money, she had given me the wrong deposit slip, and it went to one of her other accounts. And I had to take a lie detector test, and taking a polygraph is really demeaning. But the man that gave me the test said, I don't even know how they could accuse you. You're not in the mentality to do something like that. Those women and kids were my life. Where am I going to go on $4,000? Please. So anyway, I didn't get an apology. I didn't get anything. And the chair of the Administration of Justice Department at Portland State, she's still my biggest advocate besides you. She called him and said, I want a letter for her file saying that she was falsely accused and vindicated. And I said, what good is that? My spirit's broke. They told me if I got my life together, I would be part of society. And look what happened to me. And I wasn't strong enough. I didn't have enough coping skills to make it through that. I had a 17-day relapse, and then I ran to get into some outpatient because I had 8 years clean. I wasn't going back. I'll die before I'll go back to that life. So anyway, when I was in school, my therapist said, you need to deal with this prostitution stuff or it's going to come back and haunt you. And I said, nah, put that on back burner. I'm fine. Well, guess what? When I was depressed and in my apartment and my houses were gone and my job was gone and everything was gone, I started having flashbacks of my prostitution. And how I ended up was having the most severe PTSD humanly possible. I can't get on buses. I can't sit. Thank you so much. I can't sit by men on the bus. I have to get up and get off the bus. I don't know. I'm sorry. I just get really. I just should shoot every man in the world and kill him. And it's not your guy's fault. You know what I mean? You're innocent. No. Wait. So anyway, so when I went to the doctor, I had an ear infection for 19 months. 19 months. I had pus coming out of this ear. I lost all my hearing in this ear. And it turns out it could have been fatal. You know, and the doctor's putting in the notes, fatal. And she fought 9 months to get me medical. 9 months. And I finally got it. Just in time. It had went into my brain. What was it called? I forget. Something really long. But anyway, so I finally got the surgery. I got my medical after 9 months of Melanie fighting for me. But the $300 a month, I'm almost done. The $300 a month would, not only do I have to wash my clothes, I had to wash my clothes in the bathtub, but I didn't even have money for soap. So you know what I used last week? I used carpet shampooer from the carpet shampooer that my landlord brought over to do my rugs. That was all the soap I had. I couldn't go buy none. And I'm not going to steal. I'm not going back to that lifestyle. I'm not going to do it. But how are we so... Oh, and I got three shut-off notices for my electricity, five-day notices. You know how hard that is to live without electricity? And I just now got help with it 2 weeks ago. I waited 4 months to get on the list for energy assistance. 4 months. But we can't live out there without help while we're waiting. It's impossible. And I don't want to be in this chair. I'd like to be in your chairs.
Maybe you will be.
And I know I can. I'm very capable of it, but I'm afraid I'm going to give up.
No, you're not.
Because I'm tired. That's all I have for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. May I add one little more piece to the story? One of the sister agencies at Central City Concern is Old Town Clinic in downtown Portland. It's one of the free clinics, and we have to when we take uninsured patients, we have to beg, borrow, and steal appointments with specialists, and it takes months. And we've got a miracle worker gal who talks these doctors into taking our patients. And she had set up an appointment for Moxie to deal with this infection in her head. And and the appointment was made. And shortly before the appointment, Moxie found out that there was a $40 copay before she could have the appointment.
That's my nickname, Moxie.
Oh, that's right.
That's it.
I love that nickname.
I do too.
She couldn't make that appointment because she didn't have the $40. And it was really sad for the people that work so hard to get those appointments to begin with, to have that happen. So,
and when you come from a broken home, a dysfunctional family, where you never had safety, social nets, food, shelter, a sense of belonging, you know, low self-esteem, that's how we become addicts. See, we're either weak or we're strong to get through it. You know, some people that grow up in that environment can make it, but some people can't. And I was one of the ones that couldn't because I wanted to be comfortably numb to deal with the pain. And so when I got clean and sober, I swore I was going to conquer the world. I was going to help all these agencies, you know. And my dream got shattered, and I worked 20 hours a day to get it. And I just feel like if I had a little bit of help right now, my therapist says within 2 years I'd be back to work doing social work. But without the general assistance to help me get through it, I struggle all day long with just figure out just how I'm going to come up with money for toilet paper, and that consumes my total effort. Mm-hmm. So there's no room for anything else for growth.
Thank you so much, Moxie. We really appreciate you coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives.
You bet. James.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jim Ross, and I thought I was going to some obscure little social services office to talk to a couple folks.
We're just a couple folks.
Yeah. Well, someone told me to just visualize you all in your underwear.
Well, you don't even go there.
Your face is beet red now.
It's always beet red. Part of the condition. You know, pretty much it's all been said. You know, I could give you a life history here, but we don't really have the time. And I've been through it all. No, that's not why. I did laugh when I was out there and I heard someone talk about it out in the woods, because I was one of those that disappeared out in the woods. I've camped out in the woods for years at a time because I didn't know what was wrong with me for a lot of years. And I could never sit still long enough to get any kind of medical help. You know, even when I've had a life before. Back in the 90s, I had a contracting business and did my best to hang on to it, but because of the mental illness, I was just, my brother used to say I bounced around like a flea on a skillet. And I didn't have a clue what was wrong with me, and that the sleep disorders were bringing on a lot of the mental illness. And they say that sleep disorder is hard to diagnose if you don't have a sleep partner. And I would say that really what we're here for is to see what $300 a month would do for a person, you know. And I've got, it's been very hard for me to get to a sleep physician. And I learned in a film that the average physician has 8 minutes instruction on sleep disorders. And when I brought that up to my doctor, she said that she got cheated out of her 8 minutes. And in the last 2 years as I've been seeing her, you know, we've both read up on it. And the eventual demise is some sort of organ failure. You know, and I remember I was mad when I first read it. You know, I was like, who the heck ever heard of a terminal sleep disorder? You know, and I told my doctor we were writing another book. And since then, it's all happened. The blood pressure's gone up. Kidneys are going. The pancreas is gone. The swelling in the ankles and the heart's overworked, you know. And the $300 a month right now, it helped me a lot just to get a mask for my breathing machine. You know, I've been living on the same mask for over a year, and it's got glue all over one part of it. You know, all the laundry stuff and all that, I don't know. You know, compared to where I was, I'm real grateful for where I'm at, because I wouldn't have been able to sit still to go through long. And my story's going to have a happy ending. It's looking like I'm getting approved. It's been about 18 months on the SSI thing. And it's been a hard battle. She's fought some fights for me. She called me the Energizer Bunny for the longest time, because I wouldn't give up. I just kept going, and I'd keep trying to find some sort of work. And so, even when I was out in the woods, you know, I would come into town and do day labor just enough to work, you know. And I managed to gain some sort of mastery over the drinking thing clear back in the 80s. And I've had little lapses here and there, but for the most part, when I was stuck living in those tents out there, I was not out there partying up. It's just that the world baffled me so much. I just couldn't face it, you know. And I walk around downtown, and when I see a lot of these guys laying in doorways, you know, I know that they're not all drunks that are laying in there, because I've wound up laying in those doorways before. And, you know, it scares me sometimes that even what we got will get taken away. Mm-hmm. You know, and I could wind up like that. But I'm pretty tough. Even if it did and I had to sleep in that doorway, you know, I made a promise to myself on that suicidal thing. I'm a very spiritual person, and sometimes that's all I got to look forward to. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to enter that next life on that note, and that's kind of what's kept me strong.
Amen.
Yeah. But I think it's all pretty much been said here. Thanks for hearing me.
Thank you so much for coming and sharing.
I have one more comment in case you're worried about how I pay my rent. I took all those 11 ladies in my house down to sign up for Section 8, and they had an open drawing.
Oh, yeah.
And the month that she accused me of stealing that money, guess who got drawn in the lottery? That was a God shot, because he wasn't going to leave me on the street.
That's great. And Jim is in Central City Concerned Subsidized Housing.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Any quick questions? Because the bells are ringing for us. By law, we have to be on the
just
floor.
Just really quick, just want to, Melanie, what I greatly appreciate listening, and the two folks that you brought here with you, and the point being is that you've brought some folks with you that have drive in them to want to succeed.
Yes.
You know, and you've been that. Well, we talk about the bridge.
I hold a lot of hope.
And, you know, that's why I appreciate hearing those kind of stories.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming down. Thank you for all your work. And thank you to you two all. Keep unplugging. Hang in there. We're going to be trying to help you as much as we can.
I still think I'm going to win.
Yeah, Jim, we're behind you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And bless you, too. So we will close the hearing on House Bills 2914 and 2734, and we're going to close the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness on April 4th, 2007. Thank you.